This is Ranger Kidwell Ross, editor of WorldSweeper.com and the executive director of the World Sweeping Association. OSHA has a new respirable crystalline silica rule, say that five times fast, and just as inscrutable as its name may be its application to the power sweeping industry. So to find out more information about that, I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Abby Ferry, and Abby is the principal with the Ferry Group LLC. She's a safety consultant. I'll let you let her tell you more about her credentials, and she's going to speak to us about the respirable crystalline silica rule, what it could well mean for the power sweeping industry, things we should watch out for, and what it may well mean for other of the types of services that many sweeping contractors perform in terms of pavement maintenance and that sort of thing. So thank you very much, Abby, for taking your time to do this.
Thank you, of course. Thanks for having me. And it's always nice to talk to people in a proactive manner about these safety things. I am a safety consultant, and the bulk of my business is in heavy, yucky, industrial types of settings, mostly in construction and also some manufacturing and heavy civil type of engineering projects. So I see a lot of the respirable crystalline silica exposure with the workers. And as far as it applying to power sweeping, there's some interesting things in the new OSHA standard that we can talk about.
One of the things that I know we should talk about is also not sweeping, because to recognize that many of the people that listen to this, whether they're in public works or they're on the contractor side, will be doing things like paving, seal coating, grinding of pavement, and those kinds of activities. Maybe first we should just do a little overview about what the rule is going to mean, what the exposures are, and the kinds of activities that might be found on a parking lot that could come into contact with this new rule by OSHA.
Sure. The biggest new thing with the new standard is that the permissible exposure limit for the respirable crystalline silica, which I like to break down into RCS just to make it easier for repetitively talking about it. But OSHA's new permissible exposure limit for RCS is 50 micrograms per cubic meter of air over an 8-hour shift, so an 8-hour time weighted average. So my biggest advice to anyone that has or might suspect that they have some of this respirable crystalline silica exposure at their work site is to actually monitor for it. And there could be monitoring that's been done in the past at many of your sites. And the cool thing about the OSHA standard is that they will allow you to take into account information that you've gathered in the past. And I'll find the right word that they've used for that. But using this objective data that you may have, you don't have to necessarily run out and do some new monitoring to get new samples, but you can rely on information you may have from the past or historical information from similar contractors or employers that do the same type of work to try and understand what is your exposure level. The 50 micrograms per cubic meter is a pretty small figure. And another piece to this puzzle with the air monitoring is that a lot of the industrial hygienist equipment that's used to sample the air for this small amount of respirable crystalline silica, the tolerances on the equipment, the technology is kind of catching up and trying to keep pace with the OSHA standards so that we can have data that actually gets down to that level. So the other key part with this standard is that OSHA is really guiding you through how to properly work through the hierarchy of safety controls, which if you've been in especially my safety training or other safety training, you've talked about this topic. The hierarchy of safety controls is where we start with engineering controls. When we identify a hazard, we try to think of ways of how you can engineer out that hazard. So with the hazard of respirable crystalline silica, we think of things like water, using wet cutting methods. Anytime there could be dust, especially visible dust, you want to try to control that dust, whether through water or ventilation. So these are the two main engineering controls that would limit worker exposure to that permissible exposure level of 50 micrograms per cubic meter. Then we get into things like respirators, where respirators are spelled out in the new standard that they should be used when you are trying to implement the engineering controls. So whoever it is that's setting up these ventilation or water systems, they may be exposed to the respirable crystalline silica, so they would have to wear a respirator. Or if there's cases where the exposure level cannot be brought down any further through the use of engineering controls, then the engineering controls plus the respirator should be used to keep the worker exposure down lower. Now, another important, I think there's about two more big parts of the new standard that I want to give you an overview on. And these both, or all of these key points apply to the different industries that the new standard impacts. So there's a separate standard for construction and then also a standard for general industry and maritime. So depending on the type of work you do, you would follow the regulation that applies to you. So another key point is OSHA requiring a written exposure control plan. And there's some very specific items that have to go into that plan that OSHA spells out in the new standard. And part of that is medical monitoring. So if a worker, because of the exposure level, must wear a respirator for 30 days or more throughout a calendar year, then they must be in a medical monitoring program for respirable crystalline silica. So if that applies to you, there's a whole other part of the standard that can tell you how to implement the medical monitoring program properly. Then the last piece is increased training. And regardless of the industry that you're in, of course, training for understanding these respirable crystalline silica hazards is really important. And something that I've brought up in every training I've done on this topic so far is that OSHA has actually concluded or preliminarily concluded and opined that respirable crystalline silica exposure plus cigarette smoking cause a synergistic impact. So in the preamble and in the appendix to the final rule, there's actually suggestions and suggestions and best practices for your training that smoking cessation, quitting smoking is discussed with workers who have that exposure for the respirable crystalline silica. So this is all, it's a lot of stuff that's been out there, a lot of the science that was used to back up the new standard is stuff that's been around since late 90s, early 2000s, when OSHA was focusing on silica in their special emphasis program. So it's not so much super new information, but just how it's packaged and now regulated is the new piece. And of course, after I've scared you, you want to know when the final rule actually takes effect, and it took effect on June 23rd of this year, and construction had 1 year after that date to comply. So construction's looking at a June 23rd, 2017 compliance date. So that's when the rule becomes fully enforceable for construction employers. Then in general industry and maritime, they're getting 2 years, so June 23rd, 2018, and same for hydraulic fracturing industry. They also get that 2 years for compliance. So, Ranger, I don't know if you have some questions based off of all of that or have a direction that you'd like to take for the rest of the time.
I do. First off, it strikes me with the, you know, requesting that workers cease smoking, that's probably a tough call, and there's, you know, any number of them that might, to save their job, I'm just thinking, you know, they might say, okay, I quit, but not really quit. So that's trouble. And can somebody be fired for not quitting smoking if they're in a situation where they have a lot of exposure to the silica? Do we know that yet?
No, we don't know that. And there are just similar to the construction confined space standard, there's also been some legal action taken on behalf of industry against OSHA. So there are still, and I don't have a list of them, I'd have to get back to you with a list of the different legal actions that have been filed in relation to this rule. But I would imagine that because OSHA so explicitly called out smoking, that there might be some questions like that where it should be clarified. And during, so if an employer has employees wearing respirators for 30 days or more throughout a year and have to do that medical surveillance program, then that's where the smoking would come up in the setting of the employee one-on-one with their medical provider or the licensed healthcare provider that's doing these initial and other timeline exams. So during these types of exams, the doctor is required to take a medical and work history. So looking at the employee's work history as far as what other types of employers have they worked for where they could have been exposed to this respirable crystal and silica, or is this new employer that's sending them to this medical exam, is this their first chance of having exposure to the respirable crystal and silica? So looking at these, in workers' comp, we call it apportionment, where an employer would share if there's a claim situation for an employee for an illness related to this. Now, also then they'll take a medical history where they're talking about, you know, history of tuberculosis, any shortness of breath, coughing, wheezing. If you're wearing a respirator, of course, you have a fit test exam or a pulmonary function test where this kind of stuff is going to come out and the doctor will be counseling the employee on these types of things. One of them is smoking, and really smoking has always come up in these respirator exams and medical questionnaires. Usually it's just a red flag that comes up and the healthcare provider says to the employee, hey, you should quit smoking. And they check the box, we talked about smoking. So still, you know, people have that personal choice. They've got those personal risk factors that everyone takes on certain amounts of risk or doesn't take on certain amounts of risk. And OSHA is just putting in their new standard a responsibility to get this information to the workers so they understand, so they could maybe make better choices as far as smoking, not smoking, and their exposure to this type of contaminant at work.
Mm-hmm. Well, that all makes sense, and it'd be interesting the reason I ask is currently, and on a personal note, I have a friend that is going through treatment for lung cancer and hasn't quit smoking cigarettes. So I know how pervasive that problem can be.
Oh, yeah. And I pulled up the OSHA website. They've got a landing page for silica. So if you just look up OSHA silica, you probably find it. But one of the related links on there, the second related link, is American Lung Association webpage on silicosis. So they're getting the information out there for workers. But again, you know, I've dealt with lung cancer in my family as well. And it's been two never smokers that have dealt with lung cancer. So there's definitely that occupational exposure that's out there, regardless if you smoke or not. Mm-hmm. So, the training that's required with this new standard, I call it hazard communication on steroids, because you're really going through a full hazard communication training on silica, but then you're also talking about how can it impact your lungs, how can it impact your kidneys, and other types of body effects that can happen with respirable crystal and silica exposure.
So most of the employers out there are thinking, how can it impact employers? So let's talk a bit, if we can, about the sweeping industry. Let's take street sweeping as our example, because that's done during the day. It's done on job sites where sometimes there are other crews. For example, street sweeping, not so much, although there is a dust cloud that is around the sweeper oftentimes. They use water for dust suppression, but that is only more or less effective depending on where they are. And in those cases, they're leaving their dust cloud basically behind. There is some amount of cloud that's going to be surrounding them, a little like Pigpen in the old Charlie Brown cartoons, if for those who remember that. And the question is that going to be enough dust to make a difference? Are the cabs on the standard production chassis that sweepers are mounted on going to need to be positively pressurized? I would assume typically what people would do is turn on their fan and draw air from around the front of the engine, front of the chassis, and then, you know, run that through their into the cab. Now, and that's an outlier kind of street sweeping. Is let's move to also consider construction sweeping and milling and that kind of thing, where pavement is being ripped up, contractors are coming in and sweeping on construction sites where there is significant amount of dust, and now you have workers around the machine, and as well as the operator is moving pretty slowly, sitting in a cloud of dust. Is something like that easy to see that would come under the rule, or is that still not enough to maybe make a difference?
You know, I'm going to look something up here while we're talking, but I wanted to start by saying that the OSHA standard does bring up housekeeping. And under the housekeeping mention in the standard, they say almost word for word that the employer shall not allow dry sweeping or dry brushing where there could be a respirable crystal and silica exposure unless they're using wet sweeping or HEPA-filtered vacuuming to limit that exposure. So they're calling it out. And then there's another piece of the standard called Table 1. And so along with the very first pieces of advice that I started off with, the last thing would be to look at Table 1 within the standard. And there's about 18 specific instances. And this is related just to construction, but also if there's construction-like activity in general industry or maritime industries, and it's covered in Table 1 by OSHA, then OSHA has said, yes, you know, you should pull information from the construction standard, that Table 1, because what Table 1 is showing is that there are, they've got 18 activities that OSHA's called out, and so they named the equipment or the task or activity, and they specify engineering and work practice control methods, and then also required respiratory protection, and also the minimum assigned protection factor for the respiratory equipment. So it's very very specific, but also I'm scrolling through here to see if they might cover the sweeping you're talking about. A lot of it is about sawing and drilling and milling, different types of drilling, vehicle-mounted drilling, handheld equipment, jackhammers and chippers, things like that. I'm not seeing on this glance, I'm not seeing anything about sweeping itself, except for that mention in the standard about housekeeping and not doing any dry sweeping or dry brushing.
And that's actually a large factor because now, so if somebody's nearly out of water and they're about finished, they might want to, the operator is allowed to make a decision as to whether he might not switch the water on for a while. And what this is saying is that that's actually now become illegal under OSHA standards to sweep unless you have a HEPA-filtered sweeper, which they are. There are some filtered sweepers, and I'm not sure whether they're filtered down to HEPA standards or not. Unless you have that, you simply must have water. So you need to go back to the base, get water, come back, and finish your sweeping. You can't afford to just keep sweeping dry. That's what that implies.
Right, and I would say that's a best practice, not just related to this standard, but from my work in the insurance industry, that becomes what we call a general liability issue, where especially if your work is public facing and there's third parties that aren't part of the work going on at the site, so members of the general public, children, you know, people just walking by, they see clouds of dust, and you know, now we're in the age where people are grabbing their cell phones, taking a picture. They might, you know, walk a little further, see who the contractor is, or see a name on the sweeper, and call your office and, you know, find out what's going on. In certain states, I know because I've worked in California, that by law, you need to post a sign that basically says, if you see dust coming from this site, call this number. So dust suppression, for the sake of this respirable crystal and silica rule is one thing, but also, you know, everything else is still in play where we've had to suppress the dust in the past. That still goes on. The housekeeping part of the standard, I think that's something that should be clarified, because a lot of people, when we first read this standard, we're thinking a laborer and a broom. You know, when we're thinking of dry sweeping or dry brushing in the drywall type of industry, and not so much thinking of larger sweepers like what you guys do. So that's something that potentially, as part of your group, could be something you guys could get some clarification on from OSHA.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, Abby. Would there potentially be liability for a sweeper going by, let's say, sweeping the city streets, there's a cloud of dust, somebody starts coughing in the dust, and now is the sweeper potentially liable for anything that that might happen? I mean, I guess until there's a rule of law made and some legal decisions done.
Well, again, is it a worker or is it a member of the general public?
Yeah,
because
I'm thinking
if it's a member of the general public, anything goes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I would think that someone could, you know, potentially say, hey, you know, I've got an issue because, you know, I work outside doing security and this sweeping is going on every day and I can't leave my post and I'm coughing and hacking all day. You know, that could definitely be something where
sure.
A company as part of your association could be named in some kind of claim. Now, you know, is it something they could easily settle or fight and have thrown out? You know, that I'm not sure of.
Sure.
But then as far as worker exposure, you know, we're just concerned with, are we keeping the exposure below the new permissible exposure level?
And now let's, you know, the typical situation with construction sweeping is the contractor calls, the sweeping contractor says, can you come out and clean up our site? You know, usually it's, we have an inspector coming, can you be here right away? Well, that's an aside. But then whose liability is that when you're a subcontractor to a prime that you're out on a construction site? Now you show up there, you put up the dust as the sweeping contractor. Is it the contractor, the prime contractor who called him, his responsibility to make sure that the people on the ground have the correct respirators and so forth? I mean, otherwise, a sweeping contractor can show up to a job site and look around and say, well, the guy's standing here, I don't see respirators on them, I can't work. And whose responsibility is that? Do we know that? And I want to say before you answer that this is should not be construed to be legal advice in any way. You should speak to your attorney on this and so forth. But you know, what does that appear that would be the liability or the responsibility, let's call it that. Is it the responsibility of the sweeping contractor to make sure that everybody on the ground has respirators when he sees dust, or is it the responsibility of the contractor? I mean, what would be the housekeeping on that? The sweeper operator is trained to, if he's got people on the ground without respirators, to go to the manager, the foreman on the job site and say, here's the situation. Or what do you see occurring?
Right. I think that in this piece, you know, it's coming to light because of the OSHA standard, but really the OSHA standard might not have anything to do with how we'd solve this at the job site level. This would go back to your written contracts. Or maybe in the case of some of the sweeper work, it might be a purchase order, you know, more of a quicker, short fuse type of contract, but a contract nonetheless where there would be some language in there that says, you know, hey, we do dust suppression for our employees' safety. Now, if there's, you know, dust escaping the unit, you know, it's up to general contractor who rules that job site to say, hey, we're going to schedule these crews that would be in the area of the street sweeping to be in a different area at the time of the sweeping, or, you know, other types of administrative controls of moving people around to limit that exposure. But I would definitely advise to look at your contracts and purchase orders and what they do say as far as what your responsibility is. And if there's something you don't like, always push back, even if you're pushing back to the general contractor and try to work through it. Also using, like you said, your actual legal advisors that your company trusts to make sure that you've got the right limited or not hold harmless and other types of liability types of language in your contracts to make sure that you're covered. You know, it's definitely not within the scope of a sweeper to provide respirators or to even look on the job site and see who's in a respirator, who doesn't have one. It might be something that you can take care of in contract language before you even get to the site.
That makes perfect sense. And where would someone go for monitors for this kind of material? Are there
sure
names
yeah,
you want to drop?
Yeah, there's places that you can, yeah, you can rent them from, you know, I think of United Rentals. I've rented stuff like that from them before. However, air monitoring and air sampling for the silica is going to be such a fine-tuned thing that you're going to want to use an expert. And some ways that you can, you know, get an expert kind of on the cheap is using OSHA consultation. So wherever all of you are, you've got a local OSHA office, whether it's a federal OSHA office or a state plan state like I'm in here in Minnesota, and I can call the consultation office and say, hey, I'd like to do some respirable crystalline silica monitoring. And they will be really excited because OSHA just wants to keep gathering data. What led up to the new standard was that data gathering when silica exposure was part of their special emphasis program back in the late 90s, early 2000s. So they've got some data, and it was enough for them to make a move on the standard. However, I think they still want to keep collecting data, especially as people are getting more educated and understanding of what types of controls we need on the job sites. So definitely recommend that, and that's free. You don't pay anything extra to have an OSHA consultation officer, industrial hygienist consultant come out to your site and do the monitoring. You may not get your first pick of scheduling time, but you will be able to have such monitoring done. Another option is your insurance carrier or your insurance broker, and it really depends on how sophisticated your insurance carrier's risk control services are or how extensive their risk control department is. Some larger insurance carriers that we're probably all familiar with, Travelers, Zurich, some of those larger, Liberty Mutual is another one. They've got internal risk control departments that they've got industrial hygiene specialists that will come out and do this type of monitoring at your job site. And there might be some costs associated with that. Often there's not. You can make it part of your service plan. So it really just depends on the types of resources that you've got. But, you know, you can rent this kind of stuff, but it's the process for actually doing the sample sampling process and drying out the sampling media and weighing things and, you know, all the industrial hygiene lab work that goes with it. It's not something that I don't think I would even take it on at this point. Another option could be a school. If you've got a university nearby, talk to their safety and health department. There's a lot of safety and health academic programs out there, and these students need practice on how to do this stuff. The other, you know, the last resort where you would pay for the whole process is hiring an independent industrial hygiene firm to come in and do the sampling for you. So they would conduct area monitoring, which is of a job site area, and also what they call personnel sampling, where they actually place a pump on a person so that they can sample their breathing zone exposure. So they can get very, very, very precise with their measurements to get that those numbers for you. And then once you have that data, you're good. You know, you'll meet the standard. Depending on what the exposure levels are, the standard has some future sampling timelines that you should follow. So let's say you have OSHA come out and do some sampling, and you find that you're way over the permissible exposure level. So then OSHA standards have some frequencies for when you would have to do monitoring again, basically to graduate yourself out of having to monitor anymore because you'll be bringing the exposure level down.
Well, that's all fabulous information, and we're certainly, it's clear that we're talking to an expert on the topic. Is there anything else that questions I haven't asked that perhaps I should have, or any kind of an overview / wrap up that we should do on this?
Sure. I think we covered a lot of ground. I definitely encourage everyone to look up OSHA's landing page on crystalline silica and to read the standard. You can skim it. You know, I'm not going to follow you around and make sure you read it word for word. It is about 20 pages of regulatory text, but it is very good information. Also, there's some fact sheets for construction industry, general industry, and maritime on OSHA's landing page as well. And also to find out, you know, if your company has had any monitoring done, just to see if you've got any data. Also looking at what your peers are doing. Just talking about it to see what people are doing as far as best practices is going to go a long way. Then while you're doing that is to also make sure that you're training your employees to understand what's required, what to look for, how to make sure equipment's kept in good shape so that it's providing the protection that you actually think it is, especially with HEPA filtration and water systems working properly. And then another thing that came up while we were talking was the legal review of contracts. So that's definitely something that's important to look at least once a year to make sure you've got appropriate language in your contracts that reflects what you do and protects your company. So using an outside legal consultant or internal risk management types of people, or even your insurance carrier or insurance broker, that's another great resource, and it's pretty much their job to advocate and help you out with your contract language for your insurance policies. So there's a few different prongs. There's the OSHA standard, there's your contract language, and then also that general liability aspect to the general public.
Well, that's a wonderful wrap-up, Abby, and thank you very much again for your time. We've been speaking with Abby Ferry, and she is the principal in the Ferry Group. She is the CSP. Their website is the Ferry, F-E-R-R-I, group.co. And you can reach Abby also by calling 612-670-6793 if you'd care to work with her as a consultant as well. And again, Abby, we sure appreciate your time, and this will get this kick-started into the power sweeping industry, I'm sure of it.
Thank you so much for having me.